So good evening, everyone. Thank you for being here. Welcome to the LSE, if you're not usually here. My name is Ayça Çubukçu. I'm an associate professor in human rights in the Department of Sociology. I'm also the co-director of LSE Human Rights here at the school. Tonight we have a very special guest, Professor Gary Wilder from City University of New York, the Graduate Center. I will introduce him formally, but I would like to note that he's a dear colleague, friend, and comrade, and we hope this can be an open discussion following his 40-minute lecture. So first of all, thanks are due to Laura Wayne, who's sitting in the very back, for all her work in making tonight's event possible. I will introduce Gary as not only a theorist, not only an anthropologist, not only a historian, but also a committed radical thinker who is involved in grassroots politics as well. So if you feel inclined to take CLR James to our present moment in the Q&A, you're more than welcome to do that. Professor Gary Wilder is the director of the Committee on Globalization and Social Change at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, where he is professor in the PhD program of anthropology with cross appointments in history and French. He is the author, most recently, of Concrete Utopianism, The Politics of Temporality and Solidarity, which was published by Fordham University Press in 2022. Also of Freedom Time, Negritude, Decolonization, and the Future of the World, which was published by Duke University Press in 2015. And the French Imperial Nation State, Negritude and Colonial Humanism Between the World Wars, which was published by the University of Chicago Press in 2005. Professor Wilder is the co-author also of Theses on Theory and History and of two edited volumes, the Fernando Coronel Reader, The Struggle for the Life is the Matter, which was published by Duke in 2019, and the Postcolonial Contemporary Political Imaginaries for the Global Present, which was published by Fordham University Press in 2018. He is currently writing a book on CLR James entitled Recalling CLR James, Reconsidering Black Marxism, which is the title of his lecture tonight. The lecture title has been amended, if not the content of it. So we very much look forward to your lecture, Gary. We've been anticipating your visit for a long time. Before I turn the floor to Professor Wilder, let me note that the lecture is being video recorded, so will the Q&A. So you may wish to be aware of that. And in Professor Wilder's honor, we have organized a reception right outside the doors. The event will conclude at 8 p.m., after which we can further converse during the reception. Professor Wilder will speak for 40 minutes only, so we'll have an extended period of time to tease out some of the themes that he'll be examining tonight. So without further ado, welcome back to LSE, and we look forward to your lecture.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Was it like 10 years ago I was here? It's fantastic.
About 8 years ago.
Really rich mm-hmm. event, and this is a continuation. So thank mm-hmm. you, Laura, for organizing, and Ayça for organizing mm-hmm. and arranging, and inviting me here. As Ayça said, we are long-term interlocutors. I always learn not only from talking to you, but arguing with you, although we're arguing less lately. So I don't know
That's
what's
suspicious.
Happening to either of us. Yes. Yeah, we used to, it was for a long time, our connection was premised on productive disagreement. So mm-hmm. we're both open to that. Okay. I don't know if I have a sitting down reading game, but I will try. Okay, so as I just said, this talk is drawn from a book that I am currently writing that is provisionally entitled Recalling C.L.R. James, Reconsidering Black Marxism. I use recall in the double sense of remembering and conjuring. My aim is threefold. First, to grasp James's work in relation to the C.L.R. James is the great Trinidadian Marxist. You guys know that, so, or in case, just for the record. So the aim in this book about James's political thinking and political and intellectual orientation is first to grasp his work in relation to the mid-20th century world from which and to which he wrote. Second, to reflect on how his itinerary invites us to reconsider conventional narratives about Western Marxism, Black Marxism, and the Black radical tradition. And third, to reactivate aspects of James's legacy that may speak productively to a number of our current political challenges and impasses. Of course, James has long been recognized as a towering and iconic Black radical thinker who has interested scholars and activists within and beyond the university. Yet current understandings of James are often selectively based on one work, the Black Jacobins, a single period of his life, whether while he was in Britain or America or Trinidad, or one aspect of his multiplex interventions, whether Pan-African, Marxist, or post-colonial. I would argue that such divisions reveal more about our current assumptions, categories, and frameworks than they do about James or his world. Accordingly, in this project, I attempt to fold his seemingly disparate writings into an integrated account. Mm-hmm. It is important to remember that James was not a professional academic, but a public intellectual and committed militant whose thinking was always guided by efforts to organize movements in concrete situations. He developed many of his ideas in collaboration with comrades with whom he also co-published. He wrote in a range of media and registers, including book-length studies, pamphlets for workers, public lectures, articles for party newspapers, reports to party congresses, and self-reflexive letters to comrades. He never presented himself as a systematic thinker, yet a close reading of his work discloses, I think, a consistent set of concerns and ambitions. My account thus unfolds along two lines. On the one hand, I treat James as a worldly thinker confronting immediate challenges in a pragmatic way, in pragmatic ways on a variety of fronts. But on the other, I try to distill from his diverse writings a distinctive critical and political orientation that may be placed in dialogue with other thinkers, movements, and situations past and present. I thus contend that James's insights are rooted in, certainly, but cannot be confined to Caribbean experience or Black politics. As in my earlier work, I am less concerned with provincializing European knowledge than with deprovincializing Black Atlantic critical thought. My work on James pushes against two influential scholarly tendencies. One posits a path of linear development characterized by disenchantment. In this line of thinking, James is supposed to have moved from liberalism to Western Marxism to Black radicalism, or from a liberal focus on high culture to a socialist focus on revolutionary politics to a post-colonial concern with popular culture, or from a romantic commitment to revolutionary overcoming to a fatalist understanding of history as tragedy. Another tendency asserts that James was centrally concerned with the predicament of being a Black Marxist struggling to reconcile his Caribbean identity and commitment to Pan-Africanism with European Marxism and his commitment to socialism. In contrast to both of these tendencies, I underscore that from the early 1930s until the end of his political life, James identified as a revolutionary socialist without qualification. He elaborated an original form of Marxism woven from currents of revolutionary Leninism, militant Pan-Africanism, and romantic anti-capitalism. He regarded the metropolitan workers' movement and the colonial liberation movement as different dimensions of a single struggle. In his view, there could be no Black freedom under capitalist arrangements and no real socialism within a racially stratified social formation or an imperial world system. James regarded Lenin as the greatest Marxist because Lenin translated Marx's insights for his own time. James as Lenin attempted to do for Tsarist Russia what Marx had done for 19th century Western Europe. He analyzed the possibility for socialist revolution in relation to the specificity of Russian society in a new era of imperialist capitalism. Fidelity to Marx's method and central insights thus meant reworking many of Marx's categories and analyses. In the same spirit, James sought to translate Lenin and Marx for his time. Likewise, my conceit in this book is to recall and translate aspects of James's legacy for our time. Like Lenin, James combined combined principled positions with strategic flexibility in relation to changing conditions. He rejected ideological absolutism, fixed doctrines, and ready-made solutions. He attended to the complex interplay of capitalist logics and specific historical situations, systemic domination and contingent events, anonymous historical forces, and consequential individual personalities, the creative capacity of mass movements, and the need for deliberate organization with self-reflexive leadership. James continually revised his thinking in relation to his own experiences and to the changing world. At any given moment, he refused to be ideologically, strategically, or tactically constrained by his earlier positions or by the political line of a group to which he belonged. He was both a principled visionary and a canny realist, able to make pragmatic choices when confronted with imperfect options. I pay special attention to the kind of Marxist analysis and socialist vision that James elaborated. The first, I suggest, focused on a critique of alienation under capitalism and modern bourgeois civilization. The second envisioned a disalienated world that struggle might make possible. I make the case that by the time James left Britain for the United States in 1938, he had identified a set of political questions and challenges with which he would continue to grapple in the ensuing decades. His engagement with these dilemmas was refracted through his intensive study of the Russian and Haitian revolutions. Likewise, his understanding of these previous events was refracted through his immediate engagement with current situations and projects. I thus characterize James's method in terms of what I call historical refractions and political translations. I suggest that his thinking about the Haitian Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and his decolonizing present, was always mediated by and contained traces of the others. We may usefully compare his method to those of Machiavelli, Lenin, and Gramsci. A great deal of James' scholarship tends understandably to focus on his insights about revolutionary struggle and political strategy. I too explore his attention to the creative energy and history-making capacity of self-organized masses, the complex relation between masses, leaders, and parties, the challenge of simultaneously following and organizing popular insurgencies, the need to balance clear vision, decisive action, and strategic flexibility, the importance of recognizing a revolutionary situation and seizing a historic opportunity, and the risk that the very organizational infrastructure required for societal transformation can so easily be transformed into a repressive bureaucracy. But I also shift analytic attention to James as a political visionary. I emphasize that he was as concerned with the aims of struggle as he was with the means. He repeatedly distinguished between simply seizing power and what he regarded as the real task of building a new society. James regularly insisted that socialism could not be reduced to the abolition of private property, the nationalization of industry, or to state economic planning. Such a view of socialism, he warned, was the very basis of bureaucratic domination and state capitalism in Stalin's Soviet Union. His opposition to capitalism, imperialism, statism, and militarism was grounded, I suggest, in fundamental critiques of productivism, bureaucratism, and utilitarianism. A fierce critic of vulgar materialism, declaring that men are not pigs to be fattened, he challenged varieties of socialism whose primary objective was to raise people's standard of living by producing and distributing more goods. He often declared, quote, freedom is creative universality, not utility. For James, real socialism could only come into being when workers exercised direct control over production. Embracing Lenin's revolutionary claim that every cook can govern, James also insisted that socialism had to be founded upon workers' democracy, whereby ordinary people assume direct responsibility for the administration of everyday life. They would have to invent new political forms that would supersede parliamentary representation. To this end, he regularly recalled the legacies of the ancient Greek polis, the Paris Commune, the Bolshevik Soviets, and the Hungarian Workers' Councils. He conjugated these with the legacies of self-organized black masses in New World plantation societies, the American Civil War, and African liberation movements. Crucially, James insisted upon the internationalist character of this socialist democracy. Even after his break from organized Trotskyism, he continued to embrace the notion of permanent revolution and to reject the fantasy that it was possible to create socialism or human freedom in a single country. He regarded the bourgeois national state as an alienating form that reified divisions between rulers and the governed and between economic and political spheres. In his view, national states facilitated labor exploitation, bureaucratic domination, militarism, imperialism, racism, and a host of other evils. Likewise, he regarded national economies as anachronistic. He insisted that anti-colonial and socialist struggles had to be international in scale and internationalist in orientation. His writings suggest that self-managing workers' councils would be elements of regional formations, such as a socialist United States of Europe and a West Indies Federation, that would combine to form what he called a universal republic. He looked for inspiration to the multiracial crew on Herman Melville's fictional Pequod. These mariners, renegades, and castaways were bound to each other by relations of interdependence and practices of associative mutuality. Full membership in this kind of polyglot demos was founded upon shared work and a common purpose, rather than either concrete ethnicity or abstract citizenship. James indeed wrote this book on Melville while detained in the US on Ellis Island as a subversive alien. There, among another motley assemblage of international and internationalist dissidents, he claimed to have found the real-life equivalent of the Pequod's crew, a concrete enactment of the Universal Republic. This, I think, is the perspective from which James regularly reminded fellow West Indians that decolonization gave them the opportunity to struggle for what he called something new. In April 1958, James returned to Trinidad after 25 years of socialist organizing in Britain and the United States. His former protege, Eric Williams, had invited him to serve as editor of the People's National Movement Party newspaper. James accepted the invitation, knowing full well that his socialist internationalism did not align with Williams's bourgeois nationalism. But he agreed with the new leader's call for the United States to leave its military base on Chaguaramas and with his commitment to a West Indies Federation. Above all, James was motivated by the prospect that the PNM might possibly galvanize a national popular mobilization that could serve as what he called an example or springboard for similar movements in neighboring countries. James regarded this as no more than a three-year commitment during which he knew he would have to play the role of a loyal cadre who never publicly contradicted Williams, his government, or the party. He tried his best to do so for 18 months of self-effacing service, but he was chronically disappointed by the premier's refusal to follow any of his recommendations for reorganizing the party or assuming full responsibility for its newspaper. Such neglect, James believed, drove a dangerous wedge between the government and the people, weakened Williams' political standing, and offered openings to the reactionary opposition. Ultimately, for James, Williams embodied the type of short-sighted and opportunist politician that was the product of the West Indian middle-class sensibility. These functionaries for James were neither interested in nor capable of undertaking the systemic changes that would, quote, break the shackles of the old colonial system. For James, this would mean redistributing plantation land to a new class of independent land-owning peasants, fostering local industry, and confronting international capital. He argued that measures like these were necessary if independence were, again, to lead to something new beyond, he said, a national flag and a national anthem. On August 8, 1960, only 3 weeks after resigning from the PNM party and breaking with Williams, James delivered the first of six lectures on the theme of modern politics, that was his title, Modern Politics, to a large general audience in Port of Spain. He thus chose to reclaim his suppressed political voice through the adult education program of the Trinidad Public Library. These lectures, in my reading, reprise in a highly accessible fashion James's thinking about the creative capacity of revolutionary masses, the intrinsic relationship between socialism and democracy, the need for new political forms that drew upon the spirit of the ancient Greek polis and Bolshevik Soviets, the way such democracy must be linked to a new order of international socialism, and his insistence that the aim of socialist revolution is what he called the good life, or quote, the ascent of man to complete humanity. These lectures proceeded from the proposition that the world was then facing a crisis of modern civilization, in response to which all peoples faced a fateful choice between socialism and barbarism. James announces his, quote, unshakable conviction that sooner or later the people of the West Indies, as people everywhere else, will be faced with practical choices about Marxism. He explains, quote, it is my hope that these lectures will contribute to a wise choice, because a mistake could ruin our lives for at least a generation. If only it was a generation. Mm-hmm. If James began and ended these lectures with discussions of ancient Greece, I would suggest it was not out of some kind of misguided or self-hating love of European civilization. Rather, I read him as offering the Caribbean public a concrete example of a less alienated social order, one that shaped world history and created favorable conditions for human self-realization despite being so small and poor. In that society, he explained, the average citizen had a meager income, lived in simple houses, and worked unproductive land. But, he added, quote, when you walked out in the streets of Athens, you could see Plato, Aristotle, Pericles, Socrates, Phidias, Aeschylus, Sophocles. They were active in the daily life of the city. This is the spirit in which James elsewhere invokes a distinguished lineage of Caribbean intellectuals and activists, including Marcus Garvey, George Padmore, Aimé Césaire, and Frantz Fanon, whose historical experience prepared them, quote, not only to say what should be done in the Caribbean, but also to make tremendous discoveries about Western civilization itself. James thereby reminds his West Indian audience that societal achievement and civilizational greatness does not depend on territorial size, material wealth, or state power, nor can it be measured quantitatively. For James, happiness is not based on the individual ownership of goods, but on collective control over social life. Likewise, when he speaks to his Caribbean interlocutors about Soviet workers' councils, he is not suggesting that such a form could be mechanically adopted by this primarily agrarian society. I read him as reminding Trinidadians that they would have to invent their own non-provincial arrangements through which ordinary actors could exercise direct control over their economic and political lives. For James, this required a paradoxical operation. Somehow to forge a mass movement grounded in national popular will that would create an international socialist democracy. James suggested that their distinctive historical experience had prepared Caribbean people for just such an undertaking. In 1964, he reminded Caribbean students that, quote, the West Indian national personality was the product not of an ancient civilization, but of a confrontation between civilizations. James notes, quote, we are essentially an international people. We have no native civilization, native language, or native religion. Therefore, we are particularly open to the world, and the world at large is open to us. It is a difficulty, but it is also an advantage. In James's view, the long history of plantation slavery and anti-imperial rebellion had endowed West Indians with a rich capacity for self-organization and self-management. He argued that insofar as enslaved blacks were technical specialists who ran the plantations, they effectively ran those societies. It was precisely because they, quote, worked collectively on the sugar plantation that when the time came, they were ready to organize themselves so efficiently in the Saint-Domingue Revolution. This is the perspective from which he warned that decolonization should not be reduced to instrumental calculations about material welfare. Rather, it offered an opportunity to create what we might call a 20th century Caribbean polis, situated within a regional federation, itself integral to a socialist world order. I think that was his vision. He declares, quote, we were not able to choose the mess we have to live in, but we can choose our way out. As importantly, James's vision of an international socialist democracy was inseparable, as I mentioned, from what he called the good life. This form of life would be cause and consequence of a disalienated society that transcended disabling divisions between intellectual and manual labor, politics and economics, the state and the people, executive and legislative functions of government, professional politicians, and ordinary actors. Moreover, James hoped to create a world in which conventional boundaries between work, play, and art would dissolve. I think this is actually absolutely central to his whole vision of revolutionary socialism and popular democracy. He wrote about ancient Greek tragedy as a form of art that was also a popular sport in which prizes were awarded through democratic acclamation. He treated West Indian cricket as a kind of play that was also a sophisticated art form. And in his Mariner's book, he figured whaling work as a form of cooperative play characterized by highly aesthetic embodied performances. In other words, James identified forms of autonomous, interdependent association that opened pathways to non-instrumental joy and sublime beauty. A Jamesian good life would promote human flourishing by allowing social individuals within self-managing collectives to live more integrated lives. He regularly cited a passage from Marx about a situation in which workers could freely develop their natural and acquired powers or capacities. Like Marx, I would suggest, James criticized mere political emancipation from the standpoint of human emancipation. This was a non-liberal version of concrete universalism oriented to worldwide human self-realization. This take on James's political orientation does not only displace some influential interpretations of his life and work, it also invites us to reconsider some canonical narratives about the Black radical tradition. James recognized that if collectives are to make history, their practices and self-understandings need, in some sense, to be rooted in and nourished by traditions. But I would argue his writings displace conventional notions of self-identical cultural traditions. Rather, they point to a transversal notion of political traditions that unfold from multiplex historical experiences and affinities that point beyond seemingly self-evident origins and identities. In James's view, New World history both condemned and endowed Black actors in consequential ways. He argued that the Middle Passage, plantation slavery, and creolization had made Caribbeans a uniquely international people who were open to the world, as I mentioned. He contends that the revolution in Saint-Domingue was nourished by just this New World way of life. But this is not an argument about Black or Caribbean exceptionalism. He also maintains that, quote, the slaves of San Domingo, the advanced workers of revolutionary Paris, and over a century later, the Russian masses expressed the same infinite power that will display itself in all populations when deeply stirred and given a clear perspective by a strong and trusted leadership, end quote. James underscores that ordinary Euro-American masses were themselves harmed by an impoverished and dehumanizing modernity. And he reminds us that Caribbean peoples are themselves sources of modern revolutionary traditions. A Jamesian view suggests that the legacy of the ancient Greek polis does not belong to a circumscribed Europe, and that a possible Caribbean polis might be a gift to the world after the end of Euro-American imperialism. James's non-identitarian notion of political action was grounded in his internationalist understanding of New World Black experience, of the global workers' movement, and the tradition of revolutionary socialism. Note how far this is from Cedric Robinson's influential argument that the Black radical tradition was, quote, motivated by the shared sense of obligation to preserve the collective being, the ontological totality of an African metaphysical system that had never allowed for property. Robinson and many of his readers also posit an intrinsic tension, if not contradiction, between Black radicalism and Marxism. They assert that James struggled to reconcile Marxism with Pan-Africanism, that he was preoccupied with the supposed dilemma of how Black actors could embrace such Western intellectual or political traditions. I'm not persuaded by these readings, as what I've been saying should suggest. James was indeed committed to the international Black freedom struggle, of course, but he did not regard Marxism or socialism as alien traditions. He always insisted that Caribbean people were integral, if subordinated, parts of the modern West. He regarded capitalism and imperialism as inseparable elements of a worldwide form of domination. Certainly, his study of the Haitian Revolution helped to shape the kind of Marxism he came to develop. But his study of the Russian Revolution equally shaped his understanding of the slave insurrection in Saint-Domingue and anti-imperialism more generally. In both cases, he was struck by the history-making capacity of self-organized masses in what he called underdeveloped countries. It is true that James's analyses differed from the influential Eurocentrism and economism of Second and Third International Orthodox Marxism. But James was not simply criticizing Eurocentric Marxism from the standpoint of Black experience or Black radicalism. He was criticizing Orthodox Marxism from the perspective of an international socialism attuned to historical contingency, conjunctural specificity, and strategic flexibility. I would also situate James's Marxism within a broader current of what I would call Black radical humanism that traversed Africa, the Caribbean, the US, and Europe. This included a wide variety of Anglophone and Francophone Marxists and non-Marxists. Despite manifold differences, the figures I would gather under this rubric share a set of epistemological starting points and political orientations. These unfold from, first, a commitment to disalienation in the service of human flourishing. I'm explaining what Black radical humanism or radical humanism means. First, a commitment to disalienation in the service of human flourishing. Second, a conviction that human emancipation must operate on a planetary scale because there can be no freedom anywhere if it is premised on domination elsewhere. Third, such an aim requires people to invent ways of linking community autonomy, international interdependence, and planetary politics. And four, a recognition that we humans, as historically situated actors, have to pursue such projects here and now with our own resources and capacities without the intermediation of transhistorical laws, metaphysics, theologies, or ontologies. This perspective allows us to recognize the deep affinity between James's Universal Republic, for example, and W.E.B. Du Bois's interwar vision of a radically democratic cooperative commonwealth and M.A. Césaire's constitutional struggle to transform the French Empire into a transcontinental democratic and socialist federation. Consider also the reverberations between James's vision, as I've been discussing it, Du Bois's declaration that, quote, man is more than meat, and Césaire's call for, quote, a humanism made to the measure of the world. What might it mean to translate James's distinctive Black Marxism and radical humanism into our political present? There are countless ways that his concerns were key to a world that we know no longer exists. Many of his specific analyses and propositions will strike contemporary readers as quite anachronistic. And even on his own terms, in his own time, aspects of his thinking were contradictory, question-begging, and implausible. Arguably implausible. Yet there are myriad ways in which James, I think, may speak to our current challenges and impasse. Time does not permit me to develop the necessary political translations between his era and ours, but let me just enumerate a few aspects of his thinking that I think may nourish our conversations now. Some of this will seem like recap, but I want to kind of boil it down and bring it together and invite you to think about these issues in relation to our present. First, James's insistence that real socialism and popular democracy cannot be separated from one another. Indeed, one is not possible without the other. Second, James's internationalism. He contended that because imperialism is integral to global capitalism and that they together compose an asymmetrical totality, seemingly disparate conflicts must be reframed as aspects of a common struggle. Insofar as the capitalist law of values insofar as the capitalist law of value operates on a worldwide scale, provincial attempts at human freedom in one country are bound to fail. Like Lenin, James insisted that popular democracy in underdeveloped countries depended on structurally transforming both the advanced nations and the world order, not on a misguided attempt to simply separate from that order. Third, the related question of political form. James rejected the idea that the bourgeois national state could serve as an adequate framework for human freedom. He invites us to envision new forms through which to connect collective self-management in a given place, unavoidable conditions of international interdependence, and something like a planetary politics at a moment when the very future of humanity is at stake. Thus, his fourth, James's what I would call his political epistemology. His conception of transversal political traditions and his notion of concrete universalism push against influential currents of thinking today, which insist that radical critique must focus exclusively on particularism and difference. James was a fierce critic of European modernity and Eurocentric knowledge, but he neither fetishizes origins nor erects categorical epistemological boundaries. On the contrary, he challenges the identitarian logics that are themselves legacies of Western modernity. He did not simply criticize Western civilization from the standpoint of Black or Caribbean culture. In my view, he formulated a critique of modern alienation and dehumanization from the standpoint of creative popular power oriented toward building integrated societies that would enable worldwide human flourishing. James often reiterated Lenin's internationalist call to transform the imperialist war into a civil war. This formulation reminds us that in any given situation, the primary axes of actual division and potential alignment are neither given nor self-evident. They must be discovered and constructed so as to forge bonds of insurrectionary solidarity that cut across supposedly incommensurable territorial, cultural, or ideological boundaries. James was more interested in political orientation than in primordial belonging. This anti-identitarianism, I would suggest, also extends to inherited divisions on the left. He elaborated an autonomous Marxism that cuts across facile oppositions between Marxism and anarchism. Building on traditions of worker self-management and Soviet forms of democracy, he rejected vanguardism, centralism, and statism, whether in the form of state capitalism or state socialism. He always emphasized the history-making capacity of masses in motion. But he remained committed to socialist organizing and revolutionary party politics through what he called the small Marxist organization. From another angle, he challenged self-identified socialists who dismissed non-socialist currents of Black radicalism. He insisted, for example, that because socialism in the United States would never be realized without the revolutionary energies of disaffected Black masses, socialist parties and formations had to provide unconditional support to independent Black freedom struggles and to maintain their independence. Fifth, what I would call James's romantic Marxism. Part of this romantic Marxism was his insistence that the aim of revolutionary transformation is a socialism founded upon popular democracy and a disalienated good life that is not governed by the imperatives of profit, security, or utility. He called for a world in which natural and acquired human capacities are elevated through collective self-management, creative work, and aesthetic play. Note that this vision of a socialist good life was as nourished by Aeschylus, Shakespeare, Melville, Lenin, and Charlie Chaplin as it was by Toussaint Louverture, West Indian cricket, Trinidadian carnival, and the Mighty Sparrow's massively popular calypso music. There is another way in which James was a romantic Marxist, or practiced what social theorist Michel Levy has called revolutionary romanticism. James did not only identify contradictory tendencies within existing arrangements that might enable dialectical reversals, which he certainly did, he also looked back to earlier, less alienated forms of life and traditions that could be reworked in relation to existing conditions. He believed that past experiments in radical traditions whether European or Caribbean, might open pathways to more human ways of being together on every scale. Both aspects of James's romantic Marxism may serve as a useful corrective to current tendencies to restrict thinking to negative critique, to identify as pessimist realists, and to disparage utopian acts of political imagination. And sixth, finally, the deep affinity between Marxism and Black radicalism. Too many anti-imperial commentators today treat Marxism and liberalism as two sides of the same Eurocentric coin. Both, it is often said, are variants of the same Enlightenment universalism, as if universalism as such must be conflated with its actually existing, which is to say, abstract, liberal, and bourgeois forms. Such assertions typically reduce Marxism to economic determinism, class essentialism, and a stagist belief in historical teleology. But they miss, in so doing, they miss an opportunity to think with some of the most generative aspects of Marx's own work. They disregard traditions of heterodox Marxism that had developed global internationalist and anti-imperial analyses, and they erase the lineage of distinguished Black Marxists who are integral to such traditions. We might want to ask what is at stake and what price we pay by continually assembling and torching this Marxian straw man. Israel's genocide in Gaza, like so many other related issues, reminds us that James's mid-20th century ambition remains as pressing for us now as it was for him then. Our world historical moment of planetary challenges clearly calls for some kind of planetary politics. But of course, there's always a great risk that any such attempt to create these arrangements will simply authorize new forms of bureaucratic, authoritarian, and imperial despotism. Our inherited national and international forms and frames are inadequate to the task. James gives us no definitive answer to this dilemma, nor could his post-war proposition simply be applied to our political present, but he identified and grappled with problems that I think may serve us now. To consider our world through a Jamesian optic invites us to ask whether our barbarous present allows us to even continue to talk about concepts like revolution, socialism, democracy, freedom, or does it indeed compel us to do so? Has it ever been clearer that we inhabit a single, albeit unevenly developed world, such that relative freedom in some places is a function of dehumanizing bondage in others? Has it ever been clearer that radically democratic or socialist experiments in a single country cannot survive? Despite the dismal record of the Stalinist Third International and the imperial legacy of liberal internationalism, can we afford not to pursue something like a new international, or what Samir Amin called a new internationalism of peoples? What might it mean now to be inspired by James's cosmopolitan vision of a universal republic? What arrangements are most likely to create conditions favorable to the pursuit of disalienated ways of being together that are not deformed by the imperatives of boundless accumulation, unbridled extraction, state sovereignty, ethno-nationalism, and permanent war? What political forms might best ground self-determination and promote human flourishing in an era of worldwide entanglements and interdependence? Above all, as I've suggested several times, James reminds us that we must seek ways to relate collective self-management to planetary politics. I suggest that we take James's call to transform the imperial war, James's Leninist call to transform the imperial war into a civil war, as a warning against thinking about right-left divisions in terms of progressive versus reactionary states and blocs, regions and civilizations, primordial identities and static ontologies, as if a place or a state is intrinsically, states can be intrinsically reactionary, but places and peoples are not. It is time to abandon geopolitics as our anti-imperial default. Mm-hmm. Enough, I think, with this anachronistic Cold War variant of anti-colonialism. Power, wealth, and violence continues certainly to be concentrated in the global north in ways that must be contested. But it is no longer clear how effectively a civilizational critique of the West can itself serve emancipatory futures for peoples of the global South. Shouldn't we be working to cultivate an internationalist infrastructure and corresponding internationalist subjectivities that seek to transform imperial wars into civil wars? I'm going to end right here. Let me conclude by allowing that these remarks may sound, I understand that these remarks may sound irredeemably unrealistic, even distractingly or dangerously naive. This James may seem to be a revolutionary optimist who has no place in the dystopian death spiral now unfolding before our eyes. But James was remarkably attentive to what it took, borrowing a term from Trotsky, to swim against the stream of history. We on the left today are also certainly struggling against the stream. We may therefore usefully recall James's attempt, I think, to cultivate a romanticism without nostalgia and a sense of tragedy without fatalism. Like all post-war leftists, James experienced countless political disappointments and defeats insofar as he attended to catastrophic contingencies, unanticipated outcomes, reversals of political fortune, self-undermining practices, failures of communication, misrecognition, impossible choices, and double binds. He was certainly attentive to the tragic dimension of modern life. But he did not ascribe such entrenched predicaments and unacceptable alternatives to the human condition as such. He related them to the alienated forms of modern life that were historically produced by forces like imperialism and capitalism and racism. He shows us that these tragic dilemmas were especially difficult and stark for underdeveloped peoples and places, by which he meant not only Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean, but a place like Russia, pre-revolutionary Russia and post-revolutionary Russia. In short, James both recognized and contested the really existing tragic dilemmas that impoverished human life in the modern world. But far from signaling fatalist resignation, his tragic sensibility called for political action. On another front, insofar as he envisioned integrated ways of being human together, James was certainly what I would call a political romantic or romantic Marxist. But he did not subscribe to a facile Marxism which claimed to know for certain that a reconciled socialist utopia would inevitably arise. And he certainly didn't want to simply turn back the clock of time and reproduce earlier forms unchanged or uncritically. His Leninism led him to focus on political contingencies. His Hegelianism, or his dialectical Hegelianism, led him to focus on the open-ended character of social life as a process of perpetual becoming. James thus forged a revolutionary socialism that was at once romantic and tragic. He refused to concede to actually existing arrangements, even as he refused the false consolation of guarantees about emancipatory outcomes or historical redemption. He admired Lenin for his strategic flexibility and capacity to make tactical compromises in relation to concrete conditions without ever losing sight of ultimate aims. Recalling James thus reminds us that the odds are against us, but the dice are still rolling. That is now or never, human action or certain catastrophe, the ascent of man to complete humanity or the end of humanity. In his Modern Politics lectures, James told his Trinidadian auditors that some aspects of ancient Greek democracy, like the idea that the state fully belonged to the people or that every cook can govern, that these only appeared to be unworkable to moderns because they had, quote, lost the habit of regarding politics and each other in these terms. I would suggest that much of the academic left today has lost the habit of placing as much emphasis on the aim of struggle as on the means, lost the habit of imagining new political forms for a different world order, lost the habit of envisioning what Samir Amin called a world we wish to see. We have learned to roll our eyes at notions like revolution, the good life, creative universality, and human emancipation. Yet human existence under neoliberal capitalism is ever more alienated and impoverished. The imperative of translocal solidarity in the service of a free and just world order has never been more urgent. The fateful choice that James always posed between socialism or barbarism has never been more pressing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Gary. I have a series of questions. If the audience doesn't mind, I'll get the discussion started, and please do formulate your own questions. These are out of curiosity and obsession, certain concepts and strategies advanced by CLR James. I was wondering if you could speak in greater detail about this notion of the ascent of man to complete humanity. So is the complete part of humanity there a version of disalienated life? Is it, what kind of completion is at stake? Which raises the question of, well, what is lacking? Well, I could go on, how do we get there?
Yeah.
Is it a metaphysical category, this complete humanity? Is it about the organization of social life? What would, according to CLR James, complete humanity?
It's a tough question to answer because it is only, that quote appears once as a tagline in these modern politics lectures, and he doesn't elaborate. But I think it's a perfectly, not only a legitimate, but a crucial question, because in a certain way, it is a gloss for all of his work, or all of this work that he's been talking about. You know, and as I said at the beginning, he's not a systematic thinker. So even though I treated him as a political theorist in a certain way, laying out a set of, you know, a vision. This vision I have pieced together through bits and pieces. You know, it's a reconstructive work. So it's tough to know what this means. I would say, I mean, you know, the ascent of man to complete humanity, at the very least and most fundamentally, means overcoming these modern forms of alienation and division that obstruct any people's free capacity to freely develop their natural and acquired powers, whatever they may be. So what interests me about James, he uses this language of universalism and humanism, but in a non-normative and non-prescriptive way. There's a, well, it is normative and prescriptive in the sense that, like, world socialism is what we need. That no human flourishing is possible under capitalism, imperialism, racism, bureaucracy. But he kind of leaves open the possibility for different people developing these capacities in whatever way is possible. So I think for him, it's a kind of maximalist, minimalist program, which is, you know, whatever that means, we haven't gotten there yet. So he's interested in this idea of becoming, but that ascent, human self-realization, humanity's capacity to develop into what it could possibly be, the best version of it, what it could possibly be, depends on collective self-management of production and, you know, popular democracy, that and the removal of these alienating divisions. So it is a disalienated life is both the pathway to get there, and what the, you know, the ascent of man to complete humanity is a world, I would suggest, in which these divisions between work and play and art do not exist. And there's a romantic and utopian fantasy about an integrated life.
Okay.
That could assume many different forms. I mean, it's not prescriptive. It's normative. It's not prescriptive. It's not a blueprint for, you know, this is what the state would look like, this is what...
I understand that, but there seems to be a thick notion of the human and what would mean to disalienate humanity under...
Well,
so there is a thick notion of human, the human, what you called humanism in his work, which takes me to my second question.
Okay.
What is... You qualified it as saying this is a type of black radical humanism. But what I hear tonight about the type of complete humanity, where does race sit in within that vision.
Yeah.
It's an anti-identitarian understanding. But what happens to race and racism within this vision of Black radical humanism as articulated by C.L.R. James?
Great, great question. I mean, I think there are two important questions that I've puzzled over there. Mm. Where's the question of where is race, but what is Black about this
exactly.
radical humanism, which is
yes.
similar but not exactly the same.
I think have both questions.
Yeah. And that's why I'm helping you out.
Oh, thank you.
Put myself in a tough position, not a tough position, because I think it is an important question. I mean, I keep emphasizing collective self-management right. and the bigger thing. Because James, and we talked about this with the students this afternoon, this was not, and I keep saying concrete universalism, mm-hmm. because this was not an abstract humanism or an abstract universalism that purports to abstract from differences in order to reach some essential humanness, some underlying or overarching sameness. And that's why I did this whole thing with traditions. On the one hand, he challenges traditions. On the other hand, he's interested in, he uses the language of forms of life, mm-hmm. right? Rootedness, tradition, personality. So he does kind of never seeks to kind of overcome racial difference or kind of historically sedimented ways of organizing social life by racialized communities. He doesn't want to simply overturn them or erase them. He wants to figure out kind of forms of worldwide connection that would allow distinct communities to retain their distinctiveness. So that's why it's not a liberal humanism, not an abstract humanism.
Yet it seems to operate with a universal notion of alienation versus disalienation.
No, an anti-capitalist notion of alienation and disalienation.
Right, which doesn't negate it as a universalist position.
Well, I think the answer, I don't know what he would say, my Jamesian answer, because there's a game here of what he said and what he's helping.
Of course, your projections or interpretations, yes.
My Jamesian answer mm-hmm. is that these forms of alienation mm-hmm. will prevent any culturally singular community from realizing their natural and acquired capacities, their vision of a good life, whatever it is. I mean, I don't think it's for nothing that he stays minimal about what that good life is. It's integrated, there's work and play and life, but it's not, you know, it's not a prescriptive blueprint for what that should look like. Mm-hmm. Now, the question of Black radical humanism is interesting. What's, mm-hmm. you know, because I've had this conversation with people, and I've thought about it. Sometimes I say Black radical humanism, sometimes radical humanism. You know, I think, there is a current mm-hmm. of Black radical thinking that is organized along precisely these lines, and that interests me. That running through mm-hmm. so many of the towering and iconic Black radical thinkers is this insistence on these humanist propositions. And it has struck me for a long time that scholars like us, scholars of our generation who have come up through the post-structuralist mm-hmm. critique of universalism, for example, don't know what to do with that. Is this a sign of alienation? Is this a holdover of a colonial education? Is this a strategic move that is meant to, be persuasive? Is this the language of the 1930s to the 1960s, and it was, you know, historically specific? I think, you know, there may be pieces of all of these things, but I think we miss something about Du Bois and Césaire and James, and even, you know, Fanon, Winter bring it up, but they point to the door. They don't go through the door. I'm actually interested in the people who go through the door. Going up through Audre Lorde and Robin Kelly, you know, this tradition continues. Angela Davis, certainly. And
Paul Gilroy,
100%. And I think we miss something about the kind of this insistence on linking fierce anti-racism and an embrace of Black cultural singularity and historical experience mm-hmm. to something like human emancipation, that this has always been part of a certain, not all Black thinkers, obviously, but a certain current of this tradition that you know, that we don't have a good way of talking about it. So I choose to say, well, if so much of the rest of their work is so inspiring for us and is so profound, why not assume that they mean what they say and not try to explain it, these things away as problems? It doesn't mean that other contradictions don't emerge. And I think your first question about the kind of normative, the covert normativity, it, you know, brings us right to the danger and challenge of these kinds of propositions. But I think we've lost something at this moment by not having that language, not remembering that there are non-liberal traditions of humanism and universalism that we might want to reactivate, and that this is a very rich tradition for thinking about that. I think certain aspects of heterodox Marxism, what's interesting about black radical humanism, there are Marxists and non-Marxists. Mm-hmm. And certain of the black Marxists one would immediately identify James with for certain reasons are also not radical humanists in this way. And someone like Glissant, who is not the same kind of Marxist as James was, is a black radical humanist in a similar way. It was a radical humanist in a similar way. And for this, in the same way, there are certain heterodox Marxists. I would say that there are ways in which, so part of this project is drawing different kind of, constructing different constellations of thinkers that don't always belong together. So there's a way in which James, Marcuse, Lefebvre, you know, belong so closely together as these romantic Marxists in a certain way. Anyway. Sorry, more to say about all these things.
Yes, I can respond, but let me see if anybody in the audience has a burning question. Yes, please.
Thank you.
We could collect questions.
Yes.
Is the tension maybe between the kind of romanticism and the pragmatism of his political outlook?
Mm-hmm.